Hello, I'm Angela, a newsreader on the Black Country Talking News, and this week's edition of the Talking News is for Wednesday the 13th of January 2021.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by Sightloss charity, Beacon Centre. A message to our listeners who receive the Talking News on CD in the post: this remains in paper envelopes and not the usual plastic wallets, so there's still no need to send anything back to us. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. All you need to do is say, "Alexa, play Black Country Talking News." Our Talking News service is also available via the following methods: calling 01902 213 210, visiting our website www.beaconvision.org/talking-news, as a podcast on the Black Country Radio website www.blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts, on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by simply searching Beacon Black Country Talking News and hitting the subscribe button, and on your mobile or tablet device by downloading the free British Wireless for the Blind Talking News application from your App Store. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Thank you, Simon. And reading this week, we have myself, Rob, writer Graham Fisher, Mina, Edward, Helen, Sharon, Christine, Ian, Angela, and of course, Flashback Roger. In this week's edition, we have an update from Beacon, some local news from the Black Country, we have the Flashback Quiz with Mina, news from West Bromwich Albion and Wolves, and on This Week in History with Flashback Roger, a look at how the author George Orwell viewed the Midlands, the weather, Beacon Voices, which this week looks at how magnification can help those with macular degeneration. And rounding all that off, we have an edition of Tales from the Barn from Graham Fisher. We start as always with our first block of local news, heard by Angela, Ed, Christine, but first up, it's Ian.
Health chiefs said it was tough out there on hospital wards as the region targets 300,000 vaccinations a week. The coming days will be absolutely critical for the NHS in the West Midlands, with hospitals struggling under rising COVID variant case rates, health chiefs have said. Doctors, nurses, GPs and health workers are on the front line in a race against time to see if lockdown measures and the ever-increasing tempo of the vaccine rollout can head off increasing infections. Speaking on a video briefing to regional reporters, West Midlands Mayor Andy Street said, "The seven council areas that make up the regional conurbation of 3 million people were behind London, but rates had moved up." He said, "What we have got to do is every day that goes by over the next two critical weeks is look to see if the curve is beginning to change, for infections first and then for hospitalizations." Mr. Street added that only by analysing that data would it be possible to see if lockdown measures were working. Sally Roberts, Chief Nursing Officer for the Black Country and West Birmingham Clinical Commissioning Group, CCG, said the next 2 weeks would be crucial and it was tough out there on wards and in primary care. Health chiefs have said all indicators were the new, more highly contagious coronavirus variant had taken root in the region, and particularly Wolverhampton, Sandwell and Birmingham.
Rollout of the new Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine is now underway across the Black Country and West Birmingham. The vaccine is being delivered by a number of PCN vaccination services to patients in local care homes. Unlike the Pfizer vaccine, the first to be approved, the Oxford vaccine does not need to be stored at ultra-low temperatures and is much easier to move, making it easier to use in care homes and to vaccinate patients who are housebound. The vaccine will also be available from vaccination centres capable of treating large numbers of patients in the coming weeks when further supplies of the vaccine become available, as well as community pharmacies. Sally Roberts, Chief Nurse for Black Country and West Birmingham's CCGs, said, "We welcome the arrival of the Oxford vaccine. Combined with the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, we will now be able to protect many more vulnerable people against the virus and faster." We would like to assure patients that both vaccines are safe and whatever vaccine they get will be highly effective and protect them from coronavirus. So please make sure you get it when you are contacted. We know lots of people will be eager to get protected, but please do not contact the NHS to get an appointment. We will contact you as and when you become eligible for the vaccine.
A Wolverhampton school has had a successful full day of COVID-19 testing for staff and students. Moreton School is open to between 35 to 55 vulnerable children and children of key workers throughout lockdown. There are also around 20 staff members coming in each day, working in a variety of roles including teaching and testing. Last week, the school introduced lateral flow tests to ensure no one coming into school is carrying COVID-19. Head teacher Nicola Bayliss said, "It has been a challenge. We have worked over Christmas in anticipation of testing students and staff when we thought we were all coming back into school. It has been a real team effort to get it all up and running. There is a bigger uptake of this service during this lockdown than the previous one. I think parents feel reassured that their children will be safe in school, whereas before they were more cautious. Having the lateral flow tests has helped with increasing confidence in sending their children into school. Children have one test followed by a follow-up test 3 to 5 days later. They are only retested if they are a close contact of a positive case and staff are tested weekly. People are concerned about the rise in cases in the city, but this has made them more keen to take up testing." She added, "Our staff have really gone above and beyond since the last lockdown, not just with teaching, but preparing food parcels for children who are entitled to free school meals, even over Christmas, and it would be lovely for them to get the recognition they deserve."
County courts in the Black Country saw a rise in the number of property repossession claims lodged in the 3 months to September, figures show. Labour and charities have demanded that a ban on evictions due to expire on the 11th of January be extended to stop tenants losing their only refuge as COVID-19 cases surge again. But the campaign group Generation Rent has urged the government to go further to prevent renters falling into debt in the first place. Landlords submitted 92 possession claims to the Wolverhampton County Court between July and September, Ministry of Justice data shows. This was up from 25 during the previous 3 months. All claims were from private or social landlords, with none from mortgage lenders. The data also shows 23 possession claims were submitted to Dudley County Court between July and September, up from 5 during the previous 3 months. All claims were from private or social landlords, with none from mortgage lenders. Across England and Wales, the number of claims by landlords and mortgage lenders rose 28% to 4,100 in the 3 months to September. Polly Neat, chief executive of the housing charity Shelter, said, "It is just too dangerous to start evicting people from their homes with COVID cases numbers so high. We all know the country is facing some of the toughest weeks ahead. The Prime Minister has said so himself. Now is not the time for people to lose their homes, their only refuge from this raging storm." A government spokesman said, "We've taken unprecedented action to support renters, preventing people getting into financial hardship and helping businesses to pay salaries, meaning no tenants have been forced from their home. We have changed the law and landlords must now give tenants 6 months' notice before they can evict until March 2021, except in the most serious cases such as antisocial behaviour and domestic abuse, where they can take action sooner. We are reviewing the measures currently in place and will provide more detail shortly, taking into account public health advice."
A £1.8 million restoration project is underway at Stevens Park following a successful lottery funding application from Dudley Council and Partners. The National Heritage Lottery funding granted £1.4 million last year to Dudley Council and the Friends of Stevens Park. Cash will be used to fund the restoration and extension of Tintern House and to enable wider park improvements. The disused building, which was formerly known as the White House, will have a community cafe, new toilets and meeting rooms added as part of the first phase of works by selected contractors Speller Metcalf. The Emily Jordan Foundation, a charity working to support people with learning disabilities, will operate from the building. It will be developing horticultural training opportunities, a bike recycling workshop, as well as other opportunities to support people with learning disabilities to move closer towards work. Park improvements, including heritage interpretation, new access to the memorial garden, new footpaths and planting will follow. It is expected that a community development officer will be appointed in the future to deliver a range of activities and events. Councillor Karen Shakespeare, Cabinet Member for Public Realm, said, "Dudley Council is committed to preserving and maintaining our parks and green spaces, and the pandemic has highlighted just how vital they are to our collective well-being. The new use of the former White House building will have huge benefits to people with learning disabilities." Chris Jordan, Chair of the Trustees of the Emily Jordan Foundation, said, "We are all looking forward to opening our service provision at Stevens Park."
Three more local news bulletins coming up, but now it's time for our weekly update from Beacon.
Hi everyone, it's Helen here with your latest roundup of everything going on at the Beacon Centre. We hope you're all keeping well and managing with the new national lockdown restrictions okay. We know it's tough, but if you're looking for something to do, we can help. Our lifestyle team has a packed timetable of virtual activities for you to join in with each and every week. From book clubs to social chats, quizzes, yoga and the latest tech news, there really is something for everyone. The sessions will be mostly run on Zoom and you can find our virtual timetable on our social media pages. You just need to search for the Beacon Centre on Facebook, Instagram or Twitter to find us. But if you want more information and the links to join, please contact Kim via kwilliams@beaconvision.org. That's kwilliams@beaconvision.org. Or call 01902 880 111 on Monday to Fridays. Our online activities are free and open to all. So come along, we would love for you to join us. While we're under the national lockdown restrictions, we're also still supporting people to boost their skills and find work in the Black Country, Cannock, Tamworth, Lichfield and East Staffordshire. Whether you're new to the workplace or you've just lost your confidence and need to learn some new skills, we can provide the tailored support to help you. You can find out more on our website, www.beaconvision.org/how-we-help/employment. That's www.beaconvision.org/how-we-help/employment. The Building Better Opportunities Evolve and Bridges programmes are funded by the European Social Fund and the National Lottery Community Fund. Now, as you may recall, last year we told you all about our 10,000 miles challenge, which saw us challenge our supporters to complete an amazing 10,000 virtual miles over 2020, all while raising money for Beacon. We're delighted to reveal that our amazing participants ran, swam and cycled an incredible 10,845 miles in aid of people with sight loss. It's amazing. It's such a fantastic achievement given the year that was 2020. But if you're starting 2021 with a pledge to get fit, then why not do it in aid of Beacon? Email supporters@beaconvision.org and we can support you in turning your fitness drive into a fundraising effort. That's it for this week. Take care and hopefully we can catch up with you during some of our virtual activities.
Thanks, Helen. Now we head back to local news. Reading for us, we have myself, Rob, Christine, Ian, but starting us off, it's Angela.
Pub operator Marston said trading continued to take a hit during the final quarter of the year due to COVID-related restrictions. The Wolverhampton-based group, which has pubs across the region, logged a total pub revenue of £54 million during the 14 weeks ending January the 2nd. But Marston said it remains optimistic for the future and believes that consumer demand will be strong when lockdown restrictions are lifted. Pubs, restaurants and other leisure businesses have been battered by coronavirus-induced curbs, and their prospects were further hammered as Britain announced its third national lockdown earlier this week to counter rising COVID-19 cases involving a new coronavirus variant. The two-century-old brewer, known for its pedigree, Hobgoblin and Lancaster Bomber beer, expects pubs to be closed at least until March as part of the latest national lockdown imposed across the country, with some restrictions to remain on reopening. Ralph Findlay, Marston's CEO, said the pub sector has been closed for much of the last 9 months and remains in a very difficult position. Regrettably, there have been casualties across the sector, and it is vital that the government reviews urgently the opportunity to continue to support pubs as we reopen the economy in the coming weeks. Pubs are viable businesses which are part of the social fabric of Britain and which make a major contribution to the economy and the communities in which they serve. It is vital that they not only survive the short-term crisis, but are supported in order to recover and flourish. Extending the business rates holiday and VAT cut for the rest of this year is a minimum requirement. Despite these challenges, Marston's has a significantly strengthened balance sheet following the creation of the joint venture with Carlsberg and the financial headroom to weather the extended period of current trading restrictions.
A £3,800 lawnmower has been stolen from a Black Country football club. Thieves took the sit-on machine from a lock-up at Gornal Athletic on New Year's Eve. Club secretary Kevin Williams said the incident had been devastating, particularly given finances are strained due to COVID. The club, which plays at Garden Walk Stadium, launched a social media campaign to trace the yellow mower, which is a Steiger Park model. The last known sighting was near London Fields in Milking Bank, where two people dressed in black were seen riding the machine. West Midlands Police confirmed it is investigating the incident. Mr. Williams said, "This has been devastating. The club is run by volunteers. We work hard to make the grounds look nice. With the mower, the pitch started to look good, but now we're back to where we started. We're already affected by COVID situation, with a lack of money coming in. We don't know where we will get the money from for a new one. You can never have a burglary at the right time, but this is definitely the wrong time." The football club purchased the mower in February last year, thanks to a grant from the Football Foundation. However, it was only used for 20 hours due to the constant disruption brought on by the pandemic, said Mr. Williams. The mower was stored in a lockup at the base of the club grounds. It is believed the culprits first broke into the storage area on December 30th and tried to push it out of the stadium. But due to snow on the pitch, they left it on the playing field and returned the following day, where they hot-wired the device and drove it off, said Mr. Williams. Damage was also caused to the lockup door, which was left bent.
Plans to open a children's home in a residential Wolverhampton street have sparked a wave of protest from concerned neighbours. Cove Care Limited, based in Waterloo Road in the city centre, has applied to the council to change the use of a detached house in Waite Road in Bilston. However, people living nearby have told the council they fear the move could lead to crime, antisocial behaviour, disturbances and general anxiety for neighbours, some of whom are vulnerable. Other concerns include the loss of privacy, conflict between the occupants and children living at neighbouring properties, an increase in traffic and insufficient parking space. Planning officer Tracy Homfrey said, "The application is to use the property as a home for up to two vulnerable children. They may require care for safeguarding, emotional, social or mental health issues, or because their parents are incapacitated. Neighbours have raised concerns with respect to antisocial behaviour, security and a fear of crime. However, children residing here would be under the 24-hour care of trained and qualified staff. The proposal is to provide a family setting and a structured environment similar to any other family. The children would live as a single supported unit with a care manager on the premises at all times. They would be supported by fully trained and qualified care workers working shifts throughout the day and night on a one-to-one basis. On balance, the proposed use would not be that dissimilar to the current residential dwelling and would therefore not be significantly out of character with this street scene or the surrounding area."
Residents opposed to the building of a major industrial development in the Black Country are launching a last-ditch attempt to prevent it being built. The application for a business park on land off Dreadnought Road in Pensnet, owned by Hinton, Perry and Davenhill Limited, is set for final approval after winning the backing of Dudley Council planning officers. But opponents of the scheme are hoping councillors will heed their fears over road safety and refuse planning permission when the borough's development committee meets next week. They are being backed by Councillor Judy Foster, who says the 10-metre-high building will destroy residents' privacy, while a new access road will add to road safety fears. The decision on whether to grant permission is the final hurdle in a campaign which prevented the scheme being approved in May last year, after 100 objections were received. But a new application was passed only 3 months later, after the company submitted a traffic survey. Since then, the council has also given the go-ahead for a new access road on the site from Dreadnought Road. Residents have said the street already suffers from speeding cars, and the development will increase traffic and the risk of accidents. But in their report to the committee asking approval for the layout and design of the building, planning officers have said objectors' fears were dealt with when the council granted planning permission. In addition, they add a row of conifer trees opposite neighbouring homes will shield residents' view of the site.
A Victorian former factory building in the heart of Wolverhampton is set to be converted into 48 new apartments. The historic Eagle Works building on the corner of Great Vic Kiln Street and Alexander Street, close to the city centre, is now largely empty, except for an artist's studio at the front and a car repair workshop to the rear. Since it was built more than 100 years ago, the three-storey property has been home to the Reliance Hemp and Flax Mill and also housed a mattress and textile factory, a bicycle factory and a brass and gunmetal foundry. Much of the building, which was locally listed in 2001, is unoccupied and falling into disrepair, with the upper floors infested with rodents. Eagle Works Wolverhampton Limited has now applied to convert the premises into a mixture of self-contained 1, 2 and 3 bedroom apartments and studio flats. The Council's Cabinet Member for City Assets and Housing, Councillor Jacqueline Sweetman, said, "We welcome this planning application for much needed new homes in our city. It not only proposes to sensitively bring this important heritage building back into use, but will also breathe new life into the area. More and better homes for our residents and the jobs they generate remains a key priority as we look to relight our city in our recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic." Wolverhampton Council's Planning Committee is due to make a decision on the application in the near future.
We have two more news updates coming up, but now it's time to cross over to Mina.
Hello, it's time once again for the flashback quiz. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers this week in History section. But for now, here are your questions. Are you ready? Question 1. What is the name of the substance used to treat people with diabetes? Question 2. What was the name of the scientist who discovered LSD? Question 3. What device was first used in aviation in January 1942? Question 4. What was the real name of Lewis Carroll? Question 5. In what year is it said the day the music died along with Buddy Holly? And question 6. In what year did the British Museum open? As always, I'll be back to reveal the answers later in the show. But for now, good luck.
Thanks for those questions, Mina. Next up, we have more local news from Ed, Angela and Ian. But kicking us off, it's Christine.
A West Midlands police officer has become the country's first dedicated football hate crime officer. PC Stuart Ward will be based in a football unit and will be at the forefront of the unit's work to stamp out rising abuse against footballers and fans. The 34-year-old was the victim of racial abuse as a young footballer and said it means he can provide support to victims as he knows what they are going through. He said, "I'm mixed race and growing up I was racially abused. I remember being 11 years old and playing football for a junior side. It came from another player and the thing that struck me was how no one did anything about it other than my mum who stopped the game and took me off the pitch. There were parents, match officials and other players who were old enough to know right from wrong who didn't challenge the comments or support me. So having sadly been subjected to discrimination, I know the feelings and the impact it can have on you. I feel I'm in a position where I can offer help and support while looking to take action against those involved. PC Ward's role will include investigating complaints of hate crime linked to football, monitoring online interactions, and working with the region's clubs. This includes both professional and amateur level to highlight what is an offence and the importance of reporting it. He will also be going into schools to educate children around discrimination, continuing the on-site youth and yellow card intervention and prevention programmes, and linking with other bodies such as Kick It Out.
A former museum and art gallery could be turned into a cocktail bar, forming the cornerstone of a new town centre leisure quarter, a council leader has revealed. Councillor Patrick Harley, leader of Dudley Council, said interest had been expressed in turning the former Dudley Museum and Art Gallery into an entertainment venue. The imposing red brick building on the corner of St James's Road and Priory Street has been lying empty for more than 4 years since the museum closed. Councillor Harley said such a development would be a welcome boost to the area, and would represent an opportunity to boost the Stone Square area of town. We have had interest in turning the museum into a wine bar and an upmarket cocktail bar. And when you look at how popular that sort of place is at the moment, you can see it bringing in lots of people, said Councillor Harley, who himself works in the licensed trade. The gallery building, well known for its meteorological instruments outside, was opened in 1883 by Earl Beauchamp and Lord Lieutenant of Worcestershire as an art school and library. The art gallery itself opened 5 years later and a geological museum was added in 1912. The Brooke Robinson Museum, which had previously been located next to the town hall, was moved into the building in 1981, and a collection of memorabilia relating to Dudley-born football legend Duncan Edwards was also added. It once displayed works by Impressionist J. M. W. Turner, as well as renowned Black Country artist Percy Shakespeare. But the venue closed in December 2016 as part of a plan to save £150,000 a year. Some of the exhibits were moved to the new Dudley Archive Centre on Tipton Road, and others were put on display at Himley Hall.
A temporary waste treatment plant that handles tons of contaminated and hazardous soil product has asked to extend the terms of its operation, sparking a raft of protests. Dunton Environmental Limited in Horsley Fields, Wolverhampton, was first granted planning permission to begin work in May 2015, on condition all its operational activities ceased by September 18, 2020, and the land was cleared. The council-owned site in Union Mill Street had been earmarked for residential development, which was why planners placed a time restriction on the use of the land when they approved permission initially. However, the site, which the company leases from the council, has continued to operate as a waste treatment hub and is still receiving contaminated soil from other development sites. The firm has now applied to the council to continue using it until September the 18th this year. Six people have submitted objections to the new application, citing a number of reasons. Above all, the fact that the hub receives substantial amounts of hazardous waste and the soil arrives from significant distances away. Further objections include concerns over air pollution, traffic congestion, and the impact of noise on surrounding residential properties. In a report to the council, Senior Planning Officer Philip Walker said, "The time specified by the original planning permission for using the site as a waste treatment hub and the remediation works has now lapsed. The company has said that the viability of meeting the final date to cease operations and remove plant material and equipment was affected by the hub's closure for a 12-month period between 2017 and 2018. Therefore, they say further temporary permission is necessary."
The Poundland store at the Merryhill Shopping Centre is being put into a temporary hibernation. The Willenhall-based discount stores chain is replicating the measures it took during the lockdowns of 2020 by closing 44 of its more than 800 stores on a temporary basis from the end of trading on Saturday. As an essential retailer, the vast majority of its stores will remain open for business to serve their communities. The temporary measure reflects the 80% drop in footfall at some shopping centres and high streets as the various lockdown rules in place across the UK take effect. As before, the move protects the business in the short term and helps ensure it's well positioned once the UK emerges from the pandemic. In the first 2020 lockdown, Poundland hibernated around 120 stores in March and was able to start reopening them from the end of May. It says hibernation allows it to focus staff in a slightly smaller number of locations and provide better service to communities in consolidated stores. In the majority of locations where Poundland is hibernating, there is another store that remains open nearby. Where appropriate, colleagues in hibernating stores will be placed on furlough, protecting those roles for the future. Austin Cook, Poundland's retail director, said, "We learned valuable lessons during the lockdown in March about how buying patterns change as people stick to government advice to stay at home. Putting a small number of stores into hibernation helps protect them for the long term and focuses our attention on the majority of stores that remain open to serve their neighbourhoods. We hope this lockdown is short and we can reopen our hibernating stores as quickly as possible, and we remain grateful for the vital support schemes available to us that help protect jobs."
28 poplars bordering a Black Country primary school are facing the axe after a diseased tree collapsed into its grounds, sparking significant safety fears for pupils. The Lombardy poplars, close to the boundary fence with Loxdale Primary School in Bilston, are protected under the Wolverhampton GKN Sankey Sports Ground Tree Preservation Order 1984. However, after one tree fell into the grounds of the school, landowner Charles Langtree has now asked for them all to be removed, as he believes they present a significant danger to children, staff and visitors to the school. Mr. Langtree of the Land Trust, managing agents for the site, has applied to Wolverhampton City Council for permission to chop down the trees which grow along the junction of Bankfield Road and Nettlefolds Way. In a report to the council's planning committee, tree officer James Dunn said, "The tree that fell last August had decay that had advanced to the point that the remaining timber was unable to support the weight and wind that it was being subjected to. This structural failure resulted in the tree falling from the base into the grounds of the school. Given that all the trees are of the same age and species and have existed in similar ground conditions, a similar level and proportion of decay is likely to be present in the remaining trees within the group," he added. "The decline of the trees at this stage of life is not unexpected." Council planners have been recommended to approve the application, subject to confirmation of other trees in the group showing signs of decay, and also a requirement that appropriate replacement trees will be planted.
Now we have Beacon Voices, which this week is brought to us by Beacon Sight Loss Advisor Sharon, who looks at how magnification can help those with macular degeneration.
Hello, my name's Sharon, and I'm one of the sight loss advisors based at Beacon in Wolverhampton. Today, I'd like to read you the top 10 tips for those with macular degeneration when choosing a magnifier. Macular degeneration is the loss of central vision. It is not blindness, but rather low vision. Low vision means that a person's vision cannot be corrected by prescription glasses or through any medical or surgical interaction. Magnifiers for macular degeneration are meant to make the most of one's usable vision. Often people want to know what the best macular degeneration magnifier is. The answer is that there is no one magnifier that is going to meet all of one person's needs for magnification. The type of magnifiers that you select depends on what activity it will be used for. It may be used for quick spot reading of a label when you're out shopping, or can get a lengthier read like magazine or article. Performance hobbies like sewing or working in your workshop require a different type of magnifier. in order to select the best magnifiers to meet your individual needs, there are several factors to consider. Factor 1. Understand that there is no one best magnifier for someone with macular degeneration. Different tasks will require different magnifiers. Expect to own and use several different magnifiers, identifying the task you need help with, like reading a novel or checking a price tag, will determine the best match of a magnifier for the task. Number 2. You need to know the magnifying power that is best for you. By visiting a low vision centre, you can get your vision evaluated and get recommendations specifically for you. A stronger magnifying power than what you need is not better. Ask your low vision specialist to make a recommendation as to which strength will be the best for your visual needs. Number 3. Because there are so many magnifier options, choose to purchase from a place or company that offers the opportunity to try the magnifiers before buying, or allows one to return them if they are not useful or helpful to you. Using magnifiers takes some training and practice. By visiting a low vision centre at Beacon, you can get help in selecting the ones that are the best for your needs and obtain training in their use. If you have more light, you can often use a lower power magnifier. Consider lighted magnifiers to give you improved visual acuity and clearer vision. If you have more light, you can often use a lower powered magnifier. Correct positioning of the magnifier to the reading material is necessary for clarity and focus. The lower the magnifying power, the larger the field of view. When words or fonts are smaller, you can see more of the paragraph, page, or sentence in the viewing area. The higher the magnifying power, the smaller the field of view, less of a reading page, paragraph, or sentence can be seen in the viewing area. Consider the lens or screen size for optional viewing. The larger the lens or screen size, the bigger the viewing area. For example, a larger computer screen or a large low vision CCTV screen means more of a page or picture can be displayed and seen on the screen. Handheld and hands-free magnifiers serve very different purposes. Handheld magnifiers can be cumbersome when trying to read a novel, but work great for quick checking ingredients on a can of soup. A hands-free magnifier allows one to comfortably read for a long period of time or perform a hobby or task with your hands while still getting the benefit of the magnifier. As your macular degeneration progresses, your magnifying needs will change. You may find that the magnifying TV glasses that work so well for you in the past now no longer give you the clarity and magnification for clear TV viewing. However, electronic magnifiers like low vision CCTVs allow you to adjust your magnification and contrast so that even though your vision changes, you can still get your vision need met by the same device. Decide first what task the magnifier will be used for, such as reading, watching TV, performing a hobby, or checking prices at the store. Then purchase the magnifier for that specific task. To learn more about magnifiers for macular degeneration and the different styles that are available, give the Beacon Sight Loss Advisors a call on 01902 880 111. Thank you.
Thanks, Sharon. Now we have our final local news section with myself, Rob, Ian, Christine and Angela.
A brewery has launched its first gin with the aim of lifting spirits at the start of the new year. Enville Honey Gin uses the same honey that Enville Brewery utilises in its famous Enville Ale. Brewery manager Helen Briggs said that a lot of test tastings had taken place to ensure that the recipe was just right. The 40% gin is being produced externally for the brewery, which has been brewing for nearly 30 years. Enville Honey Gin, which comes in 70 centilitre bottles and retails for £26, is only currently available directly from the brewery, where customers can arrange collection from their site in Holly's Lane, Stourbridge. Helen said, "We hope that our new gin, which uses the honey featured in Enville Ale, will help to lift everyone's spirits at the start of this new year. When the pandemic is over, we hope that pubs, including the Cat Inn in Enville, which showcases our beers, will be taking our new gin as well. We also hope to supply it to local independent shops as well."
A Black Country prison worker has won £15,000 on the ITV game show Beat the Chasers. Warren Williams from Dudley won the big cash sum with just 1 second left on the clock. Warren, a maintenance worker inside a prison, had 60 seconds on the clock to answer a set of questions, while the chasers each had 40. It proved a very tight match, which went right down to the wire, but left Warren victorious and £15,000 richer. Beat the Chasers is a spin-off from The Chase and is hosted by Bradley Walsh, who hosts both shows. Speaking after his victory, Warren said, "I've always loved The Chase and watched it from the first series, but I actually preferred the new concept and thought I had more chance of winning." He prepared for the show with help from his wife and children, who quizzed him every night on topics he believed came up on the show, such as royal families, capital cities and important points of history. Asked how he felt about winning, Warren said, "Even though it was one of the best moments of my life and a memory I will treasure, it still doesn't feel real and feels like it happened to someone else. I think if I'm lucky enough to be shown on TV or when the money clears, it will hit home a bit more." Warren said it was more terrifying facing the chasers than working in a prison. "I always feared they would make me look foolish, but luckily I was wrong," he said. He was particularly excited to face the chaser called Mark Labette, known as the Beast, and he said it was a dream come true to meet host Bradley Walsh, whom he is a big fan of. Warren plans to spend the money taking his children to Disneyland in Europe and visit family members abroad.
One giant anteater, two Sumatran tigers, three giraffes, four giant African spurred tortoise, five Colombian spider monkeys. The painstaking process of counting every single animal at one of the Black Country's top attractions is underway for another year. All the animals at Dudley Zoo and Castle need to be counted during the annual stocktake. At the start of every year, all zoos in the country have to legally tot up every invertebrate, bird, mammal, reptile and amphibian living on their sites, which can be an easier task for some keepers than others. And for the first time, the week-long count is being overseen by Dudley Zoo and Castle's registrar, Nicola Wright, who will collate and input all the collected data into the Zoological Information Management System, a worldwide comprehensive database of animal health and well-being, before submitting a full report to the local authority. Ms. Wright said, "We have more than 1,600 animals on site, including more than 500 mammals, 300 birds and 600 invertebrates. Keepers all know how many animals they care for on a daily basis, but we have to officially confirm it in our yearly inventory. So the census is really just a confirmation exercise as part of the zoo licensing. This year, we do have a number of new arrivals being counted by Dudley Zoo and Castle for the first time from births on site or animals being brought in from other collections, including a Colombian black spider monkey, six Barbary sheep, an Asian palm civet, two six-banded armadillos, a Victoria crowned pigeon, and eight poison dart frogs. Animals are identified through various methods, including microchips,
ear tags, body markings, flipper bands and foot rings, which correspond to their individual records.
A brewery pub chain has completed work on its latest refurbishment in the Black Country, at a pub said to be Britain's most haunted. The Starving Rascal in Brettle Lane, Amblecote, Dudley, had been due to open as a Black Country Ales pub on December 17th, but the move of the Black Country into Tier 3 of the coronavirus restrictions scuppered that plan. King's Wimford-based Black Country Ales chief executive Angus McMeeking said that the pub, reputed to be Britain's most haunted, would now open in 2021, as soon as the restrictions were relaxed enough to open to the public. The Starving Rascal was the 38th pub to be added to the chain. Mr. McMeeking said the Black Country Ales, based in Pensnet Trading Estate, was still looking to appoint a licensee for the haunted pub. Ideally, we hope to recruit a couple to manage the pub once it's unleashed from the tier system, he said. The 200-year-old The Starving Rascal was originally built in the early 1800s and opened as the Dudley Arms. It is believed that in the early 20th century, a tragic set of circumstances led to the pub becoming haunted by a local beggar. Legend has it that on a freezing cold night, a rascal is said to have asked the landlord for food and water, but he refused. The man then lay down for the night in the doorway of the pub and was found dead in the same spot the next morning. It was in 1977 that the pub was given its now iconic name to reflect its history, and over the years it has been regularly used by paranormal researchers.
Bethany Annie Mae Joynes from Bilston, Wolverhampton, known as Bethany A, is using her newly found free time to focus on her musical career. The 18-year-old said, I have wanted to be a singer since I learnt how to talk. There are so many videos and stories I could go on forever about it. I was asked to sing backing vocals alongside a local band, and we went down to Cornwall and recorded at the Cube Studios. In September, I ended up going back there by myself to record a song that I had written and made the melody to. Bethany had planned to get back in the studio in Cornwall from January the 8th to the 11th, but due to the new national lockdown, it had to be postponed. However, the Black Country singer is not letting that dampen her spirits. As soon as lockdown is lifted, I hope to go down to the studio when it's safe to do so, she added. The first lockdown was a shock, but this time I'm taking more of a positive approach and using this time to write music and learn to play the piano. My goal is to have three more songs out in the spring and then a full album in 2022. Bethany has already been making a name for herself throughout the Black Country and via online audiences, appearing on Jim Davidson's Sunday Night Live programme on YouTube, which is watched by thousands. And now she wants to try and reach an even bigger audience. My career is now focused on music and my dream is to get my song out there to the world, she said. This year, I'm planning to get a job and save up so I can do more with my music career.
We now head over to our quiz setter, Flashback Roger, who, as always, is the man with all the facts.
Hi everybody, this is our flashback section where we take a look back at some events of the week of the 10th to the 16th of January of past years and where you'll find the answers to the quiz questions that were said earlier. So here we go again. On January the 11th in 1922 saw the first human use of insulin to treat diabetes. A 14-year-old diabetic was given the first injection of insulin at Toronto General Hospital. He had been slipping in and out of a diabetic coma and was about to die. The injections immediately improved his symptoms. However, the insulin was so impure that he suffered a severe allergic reaction and treatment had to be cancelled. An improved insulin was injected on January the 23rd, which was completely successful. On January the 11th in 1906, Albert Hofmann was born. The Swiss chemist, who was the co-discoverer of LSD, accidentally experienced the first acid trip in 1943. He continued to take small doses of LSD throughout much of his life. This and a hallucinogenic drug, popular in the 1960s amongst the Make Love Not War movement, was reputedly at the back of the Beatles song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, but that was denied as a rumour. On January 13th in 1942, was the first emergency use of an airplane ejection seat, which was when a German test pilot and his plane was about to crash. Helmut Schenk was testing a Heinkel HE-280 prototype jet engine fighter. It was the first plane outfitted with an ejection seat. Schenk's ejection was successful and he survived the incident. The Heinkel HE-280 was the first turbojet-powered fighter aircraft in the world. On January 14, 1898, Lewis Carroll died. He was born Charles Ludwig Dodgson in 1832. This famous author was also a mathematician. Whilst out on a rowboat to a picnic, 10-year-old Alice Liddell asked Carroll to tell her and her sisters a story. He spun the story of a girl named Alice and her adventures when she fell down a rabbit hole. He then turned this into his most famous book, his writing of Alice's Adventure in Wonderland in 1865 and Through the Looking Glass in 1872. On January 11, 2017, Tommy Allsup, this American musician, was the lucky survivor of the day the music died in 1959. He was touring with Buddy Holly, Richie Valens and JP the Big Bopper Richardson when he lost a coin toss with Valens for a seat on the plane. The plane crashed, killing Valens, Holly, Richardson and the pilot. Allsup was originally one of the five people reported dead in the crash, because Holly had Allsup's wallet on him at the time of the crash, and Holly had agreed to retrieve Allsup's mail at the post office. And then on January the 15th, but in 1753, an Act of Parliament created the British Museum. It was the world's first free national public museum, and it opened its doors to all studious and curious persons in 1759. Initially, visitors had to apply for tickets to see the museum's collections during limited visiting hours. In effect, this meant that entry was restricted to well-connected visitors who were given personal tours of the collection by the museum's trustees and curators. Well, that's the quiz for this week, folks. Hope you enjoyed it and you do well in the quiz. But for now, this is Rod saying ta-ra for now. Ta-ra!
Thanks, Roger. Now we head over to Mina with the weather forecast for the week ahead.
The weather for this week ahead should be notably warmer than last week, with temperatures typically hovering around 7 degrees. Again, as like last week, we expect a lot of cloud cover and very little sunshine. As a result of this, we expect low UV levels all week. The sunrise and sunset times are 8:09 a.m. for the sunrise and 4:29 for the sunset. For Friday, 15th of January, we have light cloud and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 7 degrees. On Saturday, 16th of January, we have light rain and gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 7 degrees. On Sunday, 17th and Monday, 18th of January, we start with light cloud and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 7 degrees. Moving on to Tuesday, 19th of January, we have light rain and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 5 degrees. And finally, on Wednesday, 20th and Thursday, 21st of January, we have light cloud and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 5 degrees. So that's your forecast for the week. And as always, enjoy the weather.
With news from our teams, West Brom and Wolves, and reaction to the exploits in the third round of the FA Cup, as well as an extra midweek league fixture for Wolves, it's Ian.
Charlie Austin has departed Albion on loan for the remainder of the season, joining former club QPR. The move means that Austin's Baggies career is almost certainly over, with the 31-year-old striker's contract expiring this summer. Austin joined the Baggies from Southampton in a £4 million move in the summer of 2019, scoring 11 goals in 45 appearances, but found time on the pitch hard to come by this season. He rejoins QPR, whom he left in 2016 for Southampton. He netted 47 goals for the club in 89 appearances in his previous spell. Albion sporting director Luke Dowling shared his thanks to the striker in a statement published by West Brom. "I'd like to thank Charlie for his dedication and professionalism during his season and a half with us. Many of his goals for us proved to be crucial, and I don't think any Albion fan who was at St Andrews will forget his performance against Birmingham City to earn us a valuable point at what was a pivotal point in our season. Everyone at the training ground will miss Charlie's presence, and we all wish him very well in his future career. Albion's miserable season continued after they were dumped out of the FA Cup by League One Blackpool. The Seasiders had to settle for winning the game on penalties with Kyle Edwards, Darnell Furlong and Mateus Pereira all missing for the Baggies in the shootout. But that was no more than the hosts deserved, with the League One side outperforming their Premier League opponents for long spells, particularly in added on time. The Baggies twice fought back to force extra time. Jerry Yates gave Blackpool a first half lead before Semi Ajayi pulled Sam Allardyce's side level. Gary Medine restored the hosts' advantage before Pereira levelled once more with a penalty. But while both teams created chances in extra time, it was Blackpool who showed more character and grit. And they won it on penalties, despite Yates missing the very first spot kick. Kamil Grozicki scored for Albion, but misses from Edwards and Furlong put the hosts on the cusp of victory. Albion got another shot at it when Sule Keke missed what would have been a winning spot kick. But Pereira then saw his following effort saved to ensure it was the League One side who made it through to the fourth round. West Brom will face Wolves next at Molineux this Saturday, the first time the local rivals will have met this season in the Premier League, with their last encounter taking place in 2012 when the Baggies won 5-1 away from home. Wolves advanced to the fourth round of the FA Cup as Adama Traore's magical strike saw them beat top-flight rivals Crystal Palace at Molineux. Lifting spirits following some tough results in the Premier League, Traore ended his goal drought, which had stretched back to last February, in sensational style. His scorcher towards the end of the first half was a worthy winner, with Roy Hodgson's visitors offering very little. Wolves know full well the benefits of a prolonged run in this competition, and this was a solid performance. They were given time and space to find their rhythm by the defensive-minded Palace in the first half, and Traore took advantage with an excellently taken goal. A comfortable 1-0 victory on a bitterly cold night for Nuno Espirito Santo's Chargers, who next faced Chorley Town in the fourth round, who themselves overcame a Derby side who had fielded a team of youth players due to their first team being severely affected by COVID-19. Wolves last played Chorley Town in a first round FA Cup replay in 1986, where they lost 3-0 at a time when the club was facing severe financial difficulties, having slumped into the bottom tier of the English Football League. However, this time round, they of course find themselves in a much better position, and should they beat Chorley, they could next meet either Southampton, Shrewsbury or Arsenal in the fifth round of the competition. Wolves' difficult spell in the Premier League carried on as poor defending proved costly in defeat to Everton at Molineux. After keeping Crystal Palace at bay in the FA Cup, ending a 10-game run without a clean sheet, it was hoped Wolves had tightened up defensively. But lapses in concentration were fatal against Carlo Ancelotti's men, giving them far too much time and space for their two goals. Nuno Espirito Santo's pack were caught napping for both Toffees' goals, losing 2-1 and making it 5 without a win in the top flight. The unmarked Alex Iwobi put the visitors ahead early on, before Wolves levelled swiftly through Ruben Neves and ended the first half strongly. However, they failed to get going after the break and were punished as Michael Keane emphatically headed home towards the end. Not the result anyone of a gold and black persuasion wanted going into Saturday's huge clash with Albion.
Thanks for that, Ian. We now join Ed, who this week is taking a look at what the author George Orwell found for his works Animal Farm and 1984, what he thought about the Midlands.
George Orwell did not appear to be a fan of the West Midlands. Wolverhampton seems a frightful place, he wrote, as he researched the road to Wigan Pier. Everywhere, vistas of mean little houses still enveloped in drifting smoke, though this was Sunday, and along the railway line, huge banks of clay and conical chimneys. While his worst vitriol was reserved for the slums of Sheffield, Barnsley and of course Wigan, Orwell identified the industrial heartlands of the West Midlands as the gateway to the perceived breakdown of civilization. It is 70 years ago since Orwell died from tuberculosis at the age of 46, and it is hard to think of many modern authors who have left such a legacy. His seminal works, Animal Farm in 1984, foresaw a bleak future of a world controlled by totalitarian governments. But in some respects, it was Wigan Pier which captured the North-South divide and the class of cultures which are still shaping our discourse today. Today, he would probably be described as a representative of the liberal elite, a well-heeled Londoner venturing, exploring the exotic climes of the North and the Midlands. Even at the time, his poverty tourism brought him into conflict with many of his contemporaries on the British left of politics. Indeed, original copies of Wigan Pier featured a disclaimer, warning readers that Mr. Orwell is a product of his class, and that some might find his descriptions offensive. But while his assessment of the world outside the affluent London bubble did not win him any friends, few people actually disputed the accuracy of what he wrote. What he was saying was true, there was no question about it, says Black Country historian Tom Larkin. He points out that Fenner Brockway, like Orwell, a member of the Independent Labour Party, made similar comments when he said of Bilston, "Surely no place could have grown up so ugly as this without some evil mind by having deliberately planned to wipe out every trace of beauty." But he says the problem with Orwell and Brockway was that they were outsiders with little understanding of the people who lived in such conditions. They didn't understand that people weren't living in these conditions out of choice. They were there because that was where the work was, he says. Orwell made his journey to Wigan in 1936, travelling on foot or by public transport to see how the masses lived. He wrote that, "Except for the village of Meriden, hardly a decent house between Coventry and Birmingham," although he did observe that west of Birmingham, the usual villa civilisation creeping out of over the hills. He walked 4 to 5 miles to Clent Youth Hostel, where he described observed red soil everywhere, birds courting a little, cock chaffinches and bullfinches very bright, and cock partridge making a mating call. After a comfortable night at the hostel, he set out at 10 a.m, where he walked to Stourbridge, took a bus to Wolverhampton, wandered about the slummy parts of Wolverhampton a while, then had lunch and walked 10 miles to Penkridge. Aidan Byrne, a senior English lecturer at Wolverhampton University, says Orwell was very much of his time. When the well-off would be sent to some far-flung outpost of the Empire and would be horrified by what they saw. For people like Orwell, they discovered it was not just dreadful abroad, it was dreadful at home as well, he says. When they bought things, be it cars or pottery, they didn't realise the conditions in which it had to be made. Byrne draws parallels with the way national broadcasters often report on news stories in the North. Whenever something happens in the North, the BBC sends somebody out there to do a vox pop, and they always seem to find the least informed people, as though they are the true representation of the area, he says. But while Orwell's travels away from the metropolis might have attracted their critics, Byrne says people should recognise that he and people like him were seeking a greater understanding of the world outside what they knew. "I think their intentions were good," he says. "If they hadn't gone out to look for it, they would never have understood the conditions that people were working in." His 1936 expedition was not his first taste of the West Midlands, although it must be said that his 1927 visit to Shropshire was scarcely any happier. When Orwell, real name Eric Blair, called in at Tickleton Court, near Church Stretton, he arrived with a ring in his luggage and hope in his heart. He was greeted like an old friend on his arrival, but as the tea flowed and the cake was offered, he quickly discovered that his hopes had been dashed. The news was broken to him that the object of his affection, Jacinta Buddicombe, was no longer there, and his host seemed keen to move the conversation to other things. Tickleton Court was home of the Buddicombes' grandparents, and in his youth Eric had joined them on many occasions for shooting, fishing, and generally experiencing the joys of the Shropshire countryside. The young lovebirds were torn apart when Eric was posted at Burma in 1922, but on his return the young man planned to pop the question. After being told Jacinta had moved on, Eric completely disappeared from the Buddicombes' lives, and they lost touch until February 1949, when Jacinta discovered that Eric Blair, she had known all those years ago, was the famous author George Orwell. By this time, the author was seriously ill, and while they exchanged friendly letters, there was no reunion. Orwell died from illness in January 1950, 7 months after the publication of 1984. While Orwell was clearly not impressed with the West Midlands of the 1930s, what would he make of the world today? Aidan Byrne thinks he would be shocked by the way social media giants have been allowed to gather so much information about the public. In Animal Farm in 1984, he painted a dystopian picture of an authoritarian surveillance state, he says. The state certainly has done some of this, but it is really the corporations that are doing this now, and I think Orwell would be surprised by how accepting people are of it. We have all these apps on our phones because they are fun, and we're quite happy for these social media companies to store all of this data on us.
Cheers, Ed. We now turn our attention to Mina, who has for us the answers for the flashback quiz. So, Mina, are you ready?
Yes, I am. With no further delay, here they are. Question 1. What is the name of the substance used to treat people with diabetes? The answer? Insulin. Question 2. What was the name of the scientist who discovered LSD? And the answer here is Albert Hofmann. Question 3. What device was first used in aviation in January 1942? Answer here is the ejector seat. Question 4. What was the real name of Lewis Carroll? And the answer here is Charles Lutwyche Dodgson. And question 5. In what year is it said the day the music died along with Buddy Holly? And the answer, of course, is 1959. And finally, question 6. In what year did the British Museum open? And it was in 1759. How did you do? Hopefully, fantastically. But if not, there's always another chance to improve next week. Now, to end this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News, we turn to Graham Fisher and his tales from the barn.
Hello. In the 1980 movie Tom Horn, factually based on a real person living at the tail end of the American Wild West, Steve McQueen took the titular role as a man executed for a murder that many said, and still say to this day, Tom Horn didn't actually commit. From his cell following his arrest, he gazes longingly into the distance and his beloved hills. Unaccustomed to being unable to come and go as he pleases, he breaks out of jail and attempts to flee, only to be recaptured and subsequently convicted. Looking from my window here at the barn across the Wye Valley into the Black Mountains beyond, I do not, I am pleased to say, share the same sense of incarceration as Mr. Horn, but I do empathise with his desire, and though the example is almost trite in comparison, the daily travails, duties and routines of my own time here on Shakespeare's Mortal Coil often conspire in tempting me just to drop everything and head for the hills for a while instead. I am, of course, not alone in wanting to do so. Who amongst us hasn't on more than one occasion succumbed to the human condition and that timeless cycle where at some juncture in all of our lives the grass truly does seem greener? Even though when we do take that leap of faith, and despite the received wisdom telling us that it's not all a bed of roses, the myth is still inevitably tempered by the reality of what actually lies on the other side. Yet that is still no bar to our imaginings and our longing. Over half a century ago, as a very young boy, I can remember from the safety of my mother's arms, looking from the front gate on our modest home in Blackheath, across the valley towards what was then known as Worley. The sights and sounds of the steam engines shunting and puffing. Steam trains, I'm showing my own age there now. And the smells, oh, those smells, how they still reek pungent in my nostrils. You see, there was a chemical works at Albury, a short distance away, that, as I recall, made amides and amines on set days. One smelt of fish and the other smelt of rats. My long-departed grandmother, who lived with us, used to pray on wash day for the wind to be blowing away from us, lest the smell penetrated her clean washing. If her entreaties to the weather gods were unsuccessful, then we could at least tell what day it was by the fragrance attached to our clothes. And no, I'm not making this up. We could also set our clocks by the regular explosions at the Hailstone Quarry on the Raleigh Hills behind us, when the shattering retort would signify yet another slew of impenetrably tough Raleigh rag stone was ready to be hauled from the gaping hole and taken away for construction work. Those were the days that we still had deep mining at Baggeridge, and when huge town-sized smokestack factories such as the F.H. Lloyd Foundry, Chance Glassworks, Bilston Steelworks all dominated the skyline, and every town boasted its own industry with a myriad of firms and companies filling the still ubiquitous canal narrowboats with everything from nails to enamelling to chains in a frenzy of activity which, even at that late time in our industrial development, still promoted the notion that if it wasn't made in Birmingham and the Black Country, then it wasn't made anywhere else in the world. This was all heady stuff for someone of my tender years, and I was, as yet, ill-equipped to assimilate anything other than received norms. But nevertheless, I did feel a primeval hankering to learn more about possible alternatives, a different way, the other side. A few years later, as I sat in my classroom at what was then the Raleigh Regis Grammar School, long since gone and latterly rebuilt as a college, my occasional inattentions on some wearisome topic or other would see my gaze diverting out the window and across the Stour Valley to the steep wooded slopes of Clent and Walton Hills. The otherwise clear view was often augmented, if that's the right word, especially in the height of summer, by a crepuscular red glow sitting like a huge inverted bowl and covering a large swathe of Brawley Hill, with the steelworks and Round Oak steel pad as the source of the glow at its epicentre. Across the other side of the road from there, on a site now occupied by the Moore Centre, lay Marsh and Baxter. It closed in the late 1970s, and so nowadays I address probably my third generation of school children who cannot believe how a pig would go in one end of this gargantuan factory and a sausage come out of the other. All this and more, right across a Black Country that's all but disappeared as we knew it until quite recent times. It's not all bad news, of course, and there are any number of modern industries, retail outlets and services that have stepped into the breach. The Black Country is still an inspirational place and has much to offer to those who live and work here, albeit in a markedly changed set of parameters. Plus, of course, we have the legendary Black Country hospitality. And not forgetting our distinctive cuisine of scratchins, faggots and peas, boonie pie, grotty dick, and other quite unique culinary delights. It's a wonderful region, and as a Black countryman to the core, I for one am prepared to stand toe-to-toe with anyone who would dare suggest otherwise. But those industries of yesteryear, the noises, the smells, the pollution, work hazards, social conditions, poor housing, a land described by traveller Elihu Burritt in his 1868 book Walks in the Black Country, and I quote, "Black by day and red by night cannot be matched for vast and varied production by any other space of equal radius on the surface of the globe. It is a section of titanic industry kept in murky perspiration by a set of tubal canes and Vulcans, week in, week out, and often 7 days to the week." Well, that being the case, little wonder that, like our introductory character Tom Horn, its populace looked, either spiritually or temporally, out from its confines to where the grass was, both literally and truthfully, very much greener. And so no surprise at the popularity of the likes of the Kinvalite Railway, which between 1901 and 1930 was a lifeline to the thousands of slaves of industry who sought the brief respite of a trip to Kinver, its green environs, and that cathartic intoxication of sweet, fresh air. It's all changed dramatically. Nowadays my clothes don't smell of rats, and I can breathe easier. My windows aren't rattled by explosions. The slums and mud houses are largely gone, and people don't routinely die in the pits and mines anymore. But just take time to speak with those who still recall those days. And there are lots of them, because it wasn't really all that long ago. And see if, like me, you can often detect the slightest tremble in the voice, the merest moistening at the corner of the eye, the near imperceptible twitch at the side of the lips as the reminiscences flow about whether that capricious grass really is now greener after all, at least as far as our culture, heritage, roots and personal life journeys are concerned.
Yes, it has all changed.
But is it all, every bit of it, for the better? Is it? And, having irrevocably crossed the River Styx, I say irrevocably because we fixed a price, we paid the ferryman, and we got to the other side, so there's no return. Do we not now, in some obdurate way, actually long for at least the more palatable aspects of what we left behind in our wake? Such is the enigma of the human psyche. Might it be that we imagine the grass has since assumed a slightly more lush tinge on what is now the other side, the side we left behind? Well, rather like Tom Horn, I reckon that even after all these intervening years, the jury is still yet to be wholly convinced on that one. Enjoy your black country, and do join me again soon for more tales from the barn.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org. or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!